Let's take our Bibles and turn to the 13th of Joshua. When I was in grade school, I was taught by nuns, really all of my young life. It was me and the nuns. One of the nuns that I'm sure regretted being a nun. She was kind of like the Maria from the Von Trapp family, you know. And she was a great musician, and she always, every chance she'd get, she'd have us singing. There was this songwriter, Catholic songwriter, Ray Repp, and she taught us every Ray Repp song that existed, and they just kept doing it and doing it, and she loved to do it. And one of the songs that, I don't know if this is a Ray Repp, I don't think it's a Ray Repp song, but thank God it's not. You've heard it. This land is our land. This land is your land. From California to the New York Island, we sang. If we sang that once, we sang it 1,000 times. I should be able to memorize the whole thing as many times as we sang it. It's actually it's a what song? Is it Woody Guthrie? Okay, yeah, good. I'm glad it's not Ray Repp. You could tell the Ray Repp song a mile away. Honestly, it just smacked of Catholicism. But I'm actually glad we, looking back on it, I'm glad we sang that song. I mean, it made us love our country. They're being taught exactly the opposite in school today. I'm thankful for Sister Johnette. I was her favorite, I think. I'm pretty sure I was. She would hold me back on purpose just so I could hang out with her, I think. I'm convinced that was the case. But anyway... We want to look at the reason I mentioned that, by the way, is because that would be the official song of the Israelites as they are about to inherit their assorted allotments by each tribe. This land is our land. This land is your land. And you got a big, giant section on this now in the book of Joshua. All right, we're going to just keep doing it the way that we started last week. It's kind of useless, I think, to go through it line by line. There's so many lists, so much unbelievable geography. So we'll just kind of extract the major portions. So what we're going to look at now, this week and next week at least, and possibly a third week, is chapters 13 through 21. We'll take the whole thing as one giant unit, all right? And it's all about the land being conquested now. Now it's time to give out the various proportions. Who gets what? What tract, what parcel is going to be mine? So that's what Joshua 13, really beyond chapter 21, but 13 through 21, I think, constitute a unit. All right, so let's review where we've been. All right, Joshua has completely, successfully kind of finished what God had told him to do, okay, the first half of his divine commission. All right, he has essentially conquered the enemy. And he is in control of the land, and he is in control of all of the major cities of the land. All right, God had promised them. The book opens with a titanic promise. The promise is reiterated throughout the entire book. God had said to this man, every place that the sole of your foot lands is going to be your land. And that's exactly what basically happened. All right, so the first half mission accomplished. Now he's got to fill the second part of his commission, okay? And that is divide the land so that each tribe would be able to claim its inheritance and enjoy what God had ordained for them, okay? What God had given them. And it's not just in Joshua 13 through 21 that you have this. You also have it in Numbers 34 and 35. That would be the companion passage to Joshua 13 through 21. Oh, what am I saying? What's he doing? All right, I'll bet you guys in the back can't see it, but that's what you get for sitting in the back. All right, let's go over where we've been. They come here from Ammonite and Moab country, right? They're coming over here, and they're about to cross the Jordan. Great miracle. God opens the river, the waters, and they get through on dry land. And Gilgal, becomes Israeli headquarters. There it is right there. Just about 12 miles past the Jordan on the west side. All right, remember this side is Transjordan. This is the Israel proper, okay? And Gilgal becomes headquarters. Gilgal becomes to Joshua what Capernaum was to the Lord Jesus Christ, okay, headquarters. And it's going to stay headquarters for a while. It's eventually going to shift, and I'll mention when it does, but for now, Gilgal is headquarters. All right, from Gilgal, you have the launching of what's called the Central Campaign. How many campaigns were there? Who can tell me? How many campaigns? Three, okay, Central, Southern, and Northern, okay. Central Campaign, Jericho is conquered via the miraculous from God, and on the second try around, you have Ai then conquered, right, second time around. So that's huge. With the central part captured, there now, Joshua's plan was conquer and divide, which now he has done. He's got two of the he's got two of the major cities in Canaan, and that's what he's able to do now. Okay, now with after the victory at Ai, okay, they're going to go up north on a very brief trek. They're going to divide six tribes at Mount Ebal, six tribes at Mount Gerizim, which are right juxtaposed to each other. There's that valley in the middle, and you know, there's a reading of blessings for obedience and cursings for disobedience. And everybody's saying amen, whether there's a blessing or a cursing, right? So you have that renewal, basically, of the Mosaic Covenant in an official national capacity right in the middle of Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, all right? From there, then, Joshua heads back to Gilgal. Meanwhile, they are bewitched. They're, what word am I looking for? They are seduced. No, they are... tricked, that's the one, beguiled. Yeah, yeah. Beguiled by fake emissaries from Gibeon. They were from Gibeon, but they weren't emissaries. And so Joshua falls for it, and they are totally, completely baffled and beguiled by these people. And to make a long story short, what happens is the Gibeonites wind up becoming the slaves of Israel. They wind up becoming their servants, and they remain their servants all through the rest of the Old Testament. Even after the captivity, even coming back, there are Gibeonites coming back as well. But Gibeon is eventually attacked by a five-nation confederacy up here that is disgusted with Gibeon because they have joined the enemy. And they said, well, we're going to teach Gibeon a lesson. So the Gibeonites find out about it. They send for Joshua, who's camped out here at Gilgal. Joshua comes running, and together with the Israelites, Gibeon defeats the five-nation confederacy. They put their feet on the necks of the five kings, hang them on a tree, and all is well. So now you have the total central campaign. Okay. Now some, like... Jensen and others will start the southern campaign at Gibeon. I don't think it sticks one way, half dozen another, okay? But it's from Gibeon that now you have the southern conquest, okay? All down, all through here, the major cities are going to be taken by Joshua, including what will eventually become the capital of Israel, Hebron, okay, where David will be king and reign from that city. On a hill, it's on a mountain, for the first 7 years of his reign. Okay, and then from heaven, they head back up north, and they go back to Gilgal, and then we'll see tonight that they conquer all these cities up here, with the particular prize of Hazor. Okay, about over 30 cities, 30 major Canaanite cities, conquered all in all, and... that essentially means, now there's some that aren't conquered, but essentially if you control all the major cities, then you do absolutely control Israel. Okay? Now, in these nine chapters, okay, 13 through 21, you have a very special word, right? It's the word inheritance. If you were to sit down and if you could discipline yourself to read through all of that, that'd be tough sledding to read through those nine chapters. But if you did it conscientiously, you might notice that there's a recurring word. It's the word inheritance, all right? 50 times in those nine chapters is the appearance of that word, the word inheritance. And that's very important because the Jews inherited their land, all right? It's very important. They didn't win it. It wasn't a matter of collecting the spoils, okay, of battle. They didn't purchase their land. Like most people acquire land, they do it through a business transaction. The Jews did not get their land that way, all right? The Lord was the sole owner of the land. In fact, he owns all the land, every strip of land over the entire earth. But particularly this land was set apart by God for these people. And what he is essentially going to do is he's going to lease the land to them. Okay? In Leviticus 25 and verse 23, God had made himself clear. He said, the land shall not be sold forever. Okay? No business transactions, no real estate agents in Israel. There's nothing for sale in this land. The land shall not be sold forever. Why? For the land is mine. For ye are strangers and sojourners with me. With me. Very, very amazing verse there. All right. You're aliens in this world. You're my tenants, is kind of the idea. And I'm going to lease the land to you. It's an amazing concept. Imagine having God as your landlord. And that's exactly what was that. That's not an exaggeration. That's not ridiculous. That's exactly what was going on. All right? In fact, God's actually going to charge them rent, not with money. Okay? The rent that God required, and you can probably tell me, obey the Mosaic law. All right? That's the rent. And as long as they honored the Lord with their worship, with their obedience to the Mosaic stipulations, then he promised them. All right, that's the only conditional covenant in the Bible. The other covenants in Scripture are all unconditional. This is the only conditional covenant. All right, you obey the law, and I will bless you. All right. Not only will I'm going to make your land productive. This will you haven't even begun to see what I'm going to do with this land if you obey me. Right. And not only that, I will guarantee you, you will stay at peace with your neighbors, all right? They will not lift a finger to hurt you, and if they do, I will deal with them, all right? Now, that's a pretty good deal. That's all they had to do was obey, all right? In fact, when Israel gathered at Mount Gerizim and at Mount Ebal there, okay, in Joshua 8, by the way, that's in verses 30 through 35, if you remember, okay? They agreed to all the blessings and the cursings. They understood that this was a bilateral movement, all right? Not unconditional. It was absolutely very conditional. And they accepted the conditions, all right? And essentially what they were acknowledging there at Mount, between those two mountains, was what's known as the Palestinian Covenant. Which again, you know by now, I hope, how much I hate that word. If you want to know anything at all about eschatology, one of the great men to study is Thomas Ice. He's probably the most accomplished dispensational theologian alive still today. I had the privilege of sitting under him a few times, and man, that was amazing, really. But the thing that I remember most about Thomas Ice is he made it a mortal sin to use the word Palestinian government covenant because there's nothing Palestinian about it. There's absolutely nothing. He says this is the land of Israel covenant. And you were in big trouble with him if you fudged and slipped because that's what this man said. I mean, that's the way I was first taught it in seminary. That's the way everybody was taught it. It's called the Palestinian. And I agree with him. It's a very bad name. There's nothing Palestinian about it. It's the land of Israel covenant, all right? So ownership, do they own the land? Yes and no. Their ownership of the land, friends, was purely the gracious act of God, all right? But their possession of the land, their enjoyment of that land, that depended on the conditions, all right? Their submission, their obedience to the Lord, okay? By the way, you have a whole chapter on this. In other words, when you have that little six verses in Joshua 8, that's just a microcosm of the whole chapter of Leviticus 26, all right? The whole chapter is, here's all the blessings that you can expect if you obey. And then the second half of Leviticus 26 is, here's all the cursings and penalties that are going to happen if you disobey. All right? So very, very conditional. By the way, who can tell me, where do you find the land of Israel covenant in the in a bulk situation? Do you understand that the land of Israel covenant is one of the three subset unconditional covenants that form the umbrella of the Abrahamic covenant, right? It's all about a kingdom. That's what the Bible's all about. If you have a kingdom, you got to have a land, you got to have a king, and you have to have subjects. And so these three subset covenants form out the whole of what the Abrahamic covenant is about. All right, now, where do you find the land of Israel covenant? Who can tell me? Nobody knows? Yeah, but what I want to know, where in the scriptures is the land of Israel covenant? I really want you to know this. When I leave, I would love to know that some of you know these things. The land of Israel covenant you find from Deuteronomy 27 through 30, especially chapters 29 and 30. Okay, that's where it is. And it would be good to know that. All right, they give in all the details of the covenant. Okay. So God gives these people this land, all right? They're the owners because of his grace. And friends, really what it is it is a gift of his love, all right? It's the evidence that he loves these people. In fact, Deuteronomy 4 and verse 37, it says, "And because he loved thy fathers, therefore he chose their seed after them and brought thee out in his sight with his mighty power out of Egypt, to drive out nations from before thee, greater and mightier than thou art, to bring thee in, to give thee their land for an inheritance, as it is to this day." All right, so the statement there is, God did this land allotment to these people because he loved them. All right, that's the clear statement of the scriptures. Unfortunately, we know how it all goes down, right? They completely defy the Lord. They use the law of Moses for a floor mat, and they utterly defile the land. All right, and so God is going to chasten them. He had promised them one of the promises of retaliation on God's part was, "With the stripes of men will I chasten you." And so in come the Assyrians, in come the Babylonians, and the jig is up. All right, now. Regarding to the allotment, the original allotment of the land, there are four main stages, okay, in the distribution of the parcels. And in each of these four stages, all right, you find spiritual lessons, okay? Spiritual lessons that I think absolutely carry over into today for anybody that has any aspirations of actually enjoying the spiritual inheritance that Christ has afforded us as Christians, even though we're in a completely different dispensation and are not under the Mosaic law. All right, seven of these things. We won't get through, I don't know how many we're going to get through tonight, but let's just break up the text now. All right, first of all, you have the assignments that were made at Gilgal. Okay, that's stage number one. Assignments that were made at Gilgal. That's five full chapters, chapter 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17, okay? Five full chapters of assignments at Gilgal. Now, throughout the conquest of Canaan, Gilgal has been the center of everything. It is the center of operation. Later on, Joshua is going to move the camp. He's going to move the tabernacle to a more central location. Anybody happen to know what the new location will be? Shiloh. In fact, if you have your first map number one, you have that route and ready, All right, you can find Shiloh right in the middle of Ai and Mount Gerizim. Okay, and you can see how utterly centrally located Shiloh is. All right, that will become the new capital in after a while. I'll mention that again when we get there. Now, we don't know exactly how old Joshua was at this time in Israel's history, although it's quite conceivable that he may have been at least 100 years old. It's very conceivable, and let me try to explain why. Can't be dogmatic on this, but I think it's very possible, because Caleb was 85 at this time, according to chapter 14 of Joshua and verse 10. Caleb says, I'm 85 years old, okay? And it's very likely, people have always just assumed that Joshua was kind of the older of the two, okay? Which is probably true, because we know that he lives, Joshua does, to be 110 years old. In chapter 24 and verse 19, that statement is made. He was 110 when he died, all right? And so the events described in the last half of the book of Joshua could well have taken over 10 years, okay? So that means that then he would have been either 100 or close to 100 when all this began. Can you imagine just starting out in this new, kind of a retirement life, actually, at that age? All right, now, the system for assigning these territories in the land of Canaan is given in chapter 14 and verses 1 and 2. All right, let's look there. And these are the countries. Now, those words actually don't even appear in the Hebrew. You see how the countries are in italics? So you could have said, you can understand them as allotments, land parcels. You just insert whatever you want there, all right? These are the countries which the children of Israel inherited in the land of Canaan, which Eleazar the priest and Joshua the son of Nun and the heads of the fathers of the tribes of the children of Israel distributed for inheritance to them. By lot was their inheritance, as the Lord commanded by the hand of Moses for the nine tribes and for the half-tribe. Okay, so the high priest at this time is Eleazar, all right, and Joshua. And you have one representative from each one of the tribes. In fact, those representatives are actually listed in the Numbers 34-35 passage that complements this one. For example, number one, the guy. Guess who's going to get their allotment first? All right, Caleb. And Caleb is the representative. He is appointed as the official representative of the entire tribe of Judah. Okay, and then they're all everybody's listed. For example, Shemuel is the representative for Simeon, all right? I don't know why they spell out Shemuel there when it's the exact same name as Samuel, but Eladad represents Benjamin. Buki represents Dan, and Paltiel represents Issachar, and on and on. Every tribe has their own representative in this, and then you have, remember, Joshua overseeing the whole project with the high priest, who happens to be Eleazar. And so they are casting lots before the Lord, and that was one of the ways in the Old Testament that you determined what the will of God was. In fact, even Solomon says in Proverbs 16 and verse 33, he says, the lot is cast into the lap. You take that dice, you throw it, and you don't really know what's going to happen. It says, but the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord. In other words, God actually from heaven was controlling exactly where the lot would land. And so that was how the people discovered what God's will was. Now, when Joshua relocates the camp of Israel at Shiloh, they basically change the system. So when we get to chapter 18, which is basically not in our immediate interest right now, okay, Joshua gets to the people. He says, what in the world is taking so long? How much longer are you going to wait to go in and possess the land? The allotments have been made. What's the matter with you? And so he changes the system. Now he wants three from each tribe, and basically they do the whole thing over again almost. Really interesting. But at any rate, let's look at the various sides, okay? First of all, you have the 2.5 tribes on the east of Jordan, all right, the Transjordan area. And that's basically chapter 13, the Transjordan allotment. And what you have is Reuben and Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh, all right? You were handed a sheet map tonight, right? Look at your sheet map on the right-hand side, all right? Down on the bottom section there, you see Reuben, okay? And then up on the map on top, it's actually all the same map, it's just divided. All right, you see Gad in the big dark letters. All right, and then you have Manasseh flanking them on more to the right. All right, so that's basically the allotment of the first grouping. And it's all in chapter 13. All right, Gad down there, I mean Reuben down there by Moab and Ammon, basically. And Gad and then Manasseh, as you can see, on the Transjordan side. Now, those three had already been given their allotments by Moses, particularly Reuben and Gad, okay? And they had agreed to help the other tribes conquer the land before they would return to the east side of the Jordan to enjoy their inheritance, okay? And you can read all about that in Numbers 32. Moses gives them their land. They say, we're going to help you fight, and then we'll go to our allotment. So they had asked, now really at that time, that was considered outside the boundaries. They asked for land that was outside the boundaries of Canaan because it was the richest, lushest, greenest place that you could raise cattle. They said, my, oh my, oh my, will our cattle love this? We're going to get the most succulent Kobe beef imaginable. With this, you see, and they ask for that land and they get it, okay. So the fact that these 2.5 tribes are not going to be living within God's really initially appointed land, they're not too concerned about that. Reuben's not concerned. I'm not really surprised, knowing his that passed. All right, Gad is not concerned. We don't know a whole lot about Gad. Manasseh, I guess we shouldn't be too shocked. But they're not concerned that they're outside of the parameters. And Moses graciously agrees to their choice. He lets them settle across in the Transjordan area. In fact, when we get to the 22nd chapter of Joshua, we learn that, did they make the best choice to make a living? Absolutely. There was no better place to raise cattle. That was it, okay? But man, is that going to create unbelievable problems for their offspring later on. Unbelievable problems. So you sacrifice one thing, to get another. And it's not, the sacrifice is not worth it. But if you look again at your map, those three tribes, Manasseh, really only got half of Manasseh on the right side. The other half of Manasseh is on the left side. Okay, but those three tribes, Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh, they become a kind of a buffer zone, all right, between the Jews in Canaan there and the heathen nations, all right? They become themselves a natural defense against Moab, against Ammon, and other rogue nations like that. Now, of course, they're vulnerable. I mean, they want the nice land, they want the good grass, now they're vulnerable. All right, they're very vulnerable to two things. They're the closest ones available for a military attack, which will happen, okay? And then secondly, and more importantly, they're going to be the first to go down to an ungodly influence. And that's the most important thing, right? But both of those liabilities eventually are going to work to bring about the downfall of these people. In fact, in 1 Chronicles 5 and verse 25, do I have that right? 1 Chronicles 5, 25. It says there, and they transgressed against the God of their fathers and went a whoring after the gods of the people of the land whom God destroyed before them. Talking about Reuben and Gad there. And the God of Israel stirred up the spirit of Pul, king of Assyria, and the spirit of Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and he carried them away. Even the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh, and brought them into Hala and Habor and Hara and to the river Gozan unto this day. So there you have it. There they are. You can see them on the map. They're overwhelmed by heathenism. They adopt the heathen ways, and then the heathen does them in. That's what happens to us too, by the way, whenever time we want to shake hands with the devil. All right, so here's the way it breaks down. The boundaries are given for Reuben in the south, okay, in verses 15 through 23, okay, and that's where you have the wild in Psalm 22, where the Lord Jesus is on the cross, right, and he's basically quoting most of Psalm 22. He speaks there of the wild bulls of Bashan, all right, and that's where these people wind up. They're hobnobbing with the wild bulls of Bashan. And then you have so the boundaries of Reuben, verses 15 through 23 of chapter 13. And then of the half-tribe of Manasseh, verses 29 through 32. I'm sorry, actually it was Manasseh that's going to get the wild bulls of Bashan. Manasseh gets them. And then you have Gad sandwiched in the middle there, all right, in verses 24 through 28. All right, so that's how it breaks down. And you can see on the map exactly how the breakdown works. All right, so we're talking about lessons. What lessons do we learn? I mean, I'm reading my Bible. I want to get something out of it. Can I extract a transdispensational truth out of this? Yeah, it's very obvious, I think. Don't be a borderline believer. That's what Reuben and Gad and Manasseh are, borderline believers. They want to straddle the fence. They just want to tiptoe the border, you see. Instead of entering with confidence and joy into the inheritance that God appointed for them and then rejoice in that, they do just the opposite, right? It reminds me of Psalm 47, verse 4. It says, God, shall choose our inheritance for us, the excellence of Jacob, whom he loved. Do you believe that God loves you? Do you believe that he has a plan for you? Do you believe his plan is better than your plan? That's really what has to be believed in every single life. And so, you know, people spend their whole lives running away from the will of God, as if the will of God had COVID-19 on it or something. Just something to be feared, something I don't want any part of. When all the while, the will of God, friends, listen, is the ultimate expression of God's love to you. It really is. And his will is always, 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 always the best for you. Always. Without exception. Without exception. But, of course, we go and try somebody else's will, like our own, and then wind up paying for it. All right, so since the tribe of Reuben had taken its territory from Moab, all right, it was logical for the story of Balaam to be mentioned, all right? What you see, if you glance with your eyes at chapter 13, all right, you see Balaam is mentioned in verses 22 and 23 there in a kind of a condensed form, all right? You have a condensed form there of the whole lengthier account that you find in Numbers 22 through 25. The book of Numbers gives you four chapters on Balaam. And it's condensed in two verses in Joshua 13, okay? So when Balaam, you know the story, when he sees that God was turning his curses into blessings, his advice to Balak was be friendly to these Jews, right? In fact, here's what you need to do. Invite them to one of your Moabite religious hoedowns. And get them all riled up and partied out, and of course that they did that, and that resulted in the Jewish men taking Moabite women for themselves, which was an utter violation of the Mosaic law. And then they went down after that, you know, for the count. By the way, guys, when the devil doesn't get you as a roaring lion, an obvious roaring lion, he gets you as a subtle serpent. That's exactly what happened here in Moab with these people that should have known better. Beguiling Israel and leading the male population into this horrific compromise with these hideous women. And then you pay the price for that. Now, four times in these chapters, we're reminded that the Levites are given no inheritance in the land. Okay, let me just show you. All right, you have it in Joshua 13 and verse 14. See that? Only unto the tribe of Levi he gave none inheritance. Go down to verse 33. But unto the tribe of Levi, Moses gave not any inheritance. All right, and then over to chapter 14 and verse 3. At the very end of verse 3, but unto the Levites he gave none inheritance among them. And then you have the same thing in the middle of verse 4. Therefore they gave no part unto the Levites in the land. All right, so you have four mentions of this. And the reason why was because the Lord was their inheritance. Okay? And God made himself very clear about this. I am your inheritance. The first eight verses of Deuteronomy 18. All right? Deuteronomy 10, verses 8 and 9. Numbers 18. God, I'm your inheritance. I'm your inheritance. All right? And of course, the priests, remember when we went through Leviticus and the sacrificial system in the first 7-8 chapters, the priests received certain portions from the sacrifices, depending on what kind of sacrifice it was. They would do that. All right? And so both the priests and the Levites would share in the special tithes and offerings that the people were commanded to bring. Okay? And so they were compensated that way. But other factors were probably involved in scattering the tribe of Levi. Okay, for one thing, God did not want tribal responsibilities to be a distraction from their religious duties. Okay, from their Levitical purpose as priests. God expected these men to devote themselves 1,000% to fully serving him. And by the way, he expects the same thing of his people today. God calls people, certain people, you basically give up your life. That's what you do. Oh, no, you got to be kidding me. Yes, no, I'm not kidding you. You give up your life and you serve God with everything you've got. That's what Paul means when he tells Timothy, no man that warreth entangleth himself in the affairs of this life so that he can please the one that enlisted him as a soldier. The same exact thing, okay? So he wants them dedicated. I mean, it was a full-time job. It was round the clock, and he expected them to get the job done. And he also wanted them to be salt and light wherever they were, all throughout the nation. That's why he had them spread out all over from pillar to post in the land as they lived among the people and were teaching the people the law. The scribes emerged mostly out of the Levites, okay? So Simeon and Levi were scattered. Basically, I'll show you why. Another major reason why. Remember Jacob's deathbed prophecies? Yeah. When he goes through all 12 of them. And when he gets to Simeon in Genesis 49, verse 5, Simeon and Levi are brethren, instruments of cruelty, are in their habitations. O my soul, come not thou into their secret, unto their assembly, mine honor. Be not thou united, for in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they digged down a wall. Remember what was Jacob referring to there in his deathbed prophecy for those two guys, Simeon and Levi? Darlu. Yes, the revenge of their sister Dinah, right, who was basically raped, all right. But, you know, that's in Genesis 34. But that's a major reason, because Jacob prophesied on his deathbed that they would be split up and separated. Now, Simeon is going to get an allotment, but eventually they're just swallowed up into Judah. That's why if you notice on your map, you see Simeon on the map? All right, they're, because they just become amalgamated into Judah, all right, even though they were given an allotment. Now, since Caleb belonged to the tribe of Judah, how do we know that? We would not know that except for Numbers 13, verse 30, where it says that Caleb is a Jew, was of Judah, all right? And we know what the deal is with Caleb. He was one of the two faithful spies, and so he's going to get his inheritance first. He becomes the representative of Judah for the allotment. And, of course, Joshua, interestingly enough, the other faithful spy, he's going to get his inheritance last. We don't read about Joshua's inheritance until chapter 19, where God gives him. By the way, anybody remember what tribe was Joshua from? What tribe was Joshua from? He was not a Judite. He was from Ephraim. And so he gets his own mountain in Ephraim and the chief city that was in that mountain place called Timnath-Serah. And now that becomes Joshua's whole city. All right, but he doesn't get it last. He gets his inheritance last. And you know what? Caleb was a constant buzz in Joshua's ear the whole time, reminding him day and night of the promise that Moses had made them 45 years earlier. Think about that now. 45 years, Caleb, don't forget what Moses said. Don't forget it. Don't forget what Moses said over and over and over and over again. In fact, I know that that's true because it keeps on showing up in the text. Look at chapter 14, verse 24. Joshua 14. Oh, there is no verse 24. What do I mean here? I meant Numbers. I'm sorry. We're over time already. For the sake of time, it's not Joshua, it's Numbers. 14, 24, verse 30. Deuteronomy 1, all right? The same thing repeated, that they would survive the years of the wandering, they would receive their inheritance in the land. All right, so that promise gave Joshua and Caleb the impetus to keep on keeping on. Just like the promises of God should do that for you, okay? It gave them the courage to endure the years of wandering and waiting and wandering and waiting. In fact, we have the same thing said about these guys over and over again. They're going to get a great inheritance because they wholly followed the Lord with a full heart. It says that mostly about Caleb, but it also says the same thing about Joshua. They gave everything to Christ, everything, holding nothing back, right? So I'm in a pilgrim journey. I have to step out these doors and face these horrendous satanic people out there in the world, just like you do. So what application can I take from this? Well, I'm going to be encouraged in my pilgrim journey, right? I know God's made some promises to me. In fact, I have already received my inheritance. Ephesians 1:3 says that I have been blessed with every conceivable spiritual blessing that's in existence. I've been blessed. And I'm going to claim that blessing. And so since I've got this glorious inheritance before me, I'm going to even through the valley of the shadow of death out here in Kitsap County, I'm going to hold my head up and praise God as I'm doing it. That's the application. Because I know that the best is yet to come. That's what Peter's talking about in chapter 1. We have an inheritance, incorruptible, undefiled, reserved for you in heaven. See, you see the connection of the two texts. It's quite remarkable. Well, I tell you, I love the book of Joshua. Unfortunately, we're out of time. That's too bad.